Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Stuck on Mars. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Perseverance rover has been collecting Martian rocks for the eventual return to Earth in the 2030s, but that plan is stuck on the ground. Concerns have been raised about the cost and timeline of the mission. We'll speak with space industry analyst Laura Forsick about getting samples from our planetary neighbor and the challenges that lie ahead. Then, a human mission to Mars would mean years away from Earth. How might humans fare while isolated on the red planet for so long? Well, NASA is searching for volunteers to live in a Mars simulator here on Earth for a year to investigate that very question. We'll speak with Sharifeh Ghassel, an analog astronaut and mental health professional who lived and worked in a Mars simulator. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Rovers have been exploring the surface of Mars for decades, but scientists really want to get their hands on Mars rocks here on Earth. The Mars Sample Return Mission aims to deliver those samples to those scientists in the 2030s, but concerns over schedule and cost are putting that mission in jeopardy. Here to talk about this sample return mission is Laura Forsick, a space industry analyst and founder of the consulting firm Astrolytical. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
Always great to chat with you. I called on you today to chat a little bit about more sample return. We've heard a bit of this mission coming up in some congressional hearings, and now NASA's Office of Inspector General has released findings on this program. What do we know?
We know that this program has ballooned in cost and been delayed, which is not necessarily unusual for a NASA program. However, it is starting to affect other programs, and NASA is anticipating that it will not get the budget it needs for Mars Sample Return, and is starting to cut back, which is affecting jobs, specifically at JPL in California.
Let's take a step back and a broader look and talk a bit about what Mars Sample Return is. Because when you think about it and you just hear that name, it doesn't sound very complicated. It's just bringing rocks back from another planet. But that is actually really complicated, right? Tell us a bit about what the goal of it is and why this is such a challenging endeavor.
This is a complex mission. So if you remember back when we landed Perseverance, the rover on Mars, it actually collected samples. And it has this cache of samples of Mars regolith, that's the dirt and dust, that it is like really storing for some other vehicle to come and pick up and then return back to Earth. And it is a multi-step process. We don't have time to get into all the steps. It's actually a program that we're partnered with the European Space Agency on. And so ESA is doing some of the projects, but NASA is really doing the bulk of it. And it is so complex. We've never done anything quite like this before. If you remember the Apollo days, they brought back lots of sample return, but that was because humans are much more efficient than people. And so this is all robotic, which means everything needs to go correctly. And that means there needs to be a lot of redundancy. And so that adds cost and complexity.
And one of the things that sticks out to me is that it's not only, you know, we've landed on Mars. We've landed on Mars successfully a few times. It's not an easy task. But for a Mars sample return, you would actually have to lift off and launch a vehicle from another planet and then bring it back to Earth. I mean, that in itself is quite complicated, right?
It is. It is. And it's a multi-step process where there's handoffs. And so what we're seeing is the complexity and the design challenges really delaying the program. It is delayed now more than a year. It has ballooned in cost. As I said, it's gone from approximately $2.5 billion. That was the estimate from 4 years ago, to now over $10 billion, over $11 billion perhaps is the latest unofficial estimate from the independent review last September.
And to put that into perspective, NASA usually gets around, what, 20-some billion a year from Congress?
That's correct. But right now, Congress is really dragging its feet on any kind of budget resolution. So we're having a continuing resolution, which means that NASA is effectively getting a little bit of a cost cut because of inflation. So NASA is anticipating that they are not going to get the money they need for Mars Sample Return. So they actually started cutting back at the end of last last year, which unfortunately has meant that there's been a lot of effect with other programs. There's been a lot of effect with jobs. There's even some disagreement within Congress. So last year, the Senate in their FY 2024 budget proposal actually threatened to cancel Mars sample return. However, a recent letter put out by a combination of senators and House of Representatives in California actually encouraged the funding of Mars sample return by NASA because, like I said, JPL has had layoffs, and that is really affecting the whole workforce over there at the Jet Propulsion Lab.
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Tori.
I want to dive into to kind of the budget aspects and the timing aspects of it, but I also want to kind of touch upon the importance of a mission like this. Why is this so important? We've had plenty of people on our show, supporting this mission. Their work is directly affected by this mission. But overall, Laura, why is this so critical to our understanding of space science? Why do we need to have a Mars sample return mission?
We do not fully understand what Mars is made of and the geological process that made the planet Mars. We do have Mars rocks that came to us in the form of meteorites. But when you have meteorites come and fall on Earth, we don't know where they came from. They've gone through the atmosphere. They've gone through space. And so what we want is a actual sample from a point on Mars that we know of, several points, in fact. And that gives us a lot of understanding about the geology of Mars and the way Mars was formed. And it also helps us when we're going to send humans, because that's the ultimate goal, is to send people to Mars. When we are ready to do that, we need to understand, is there life on Mars? Was there ever life on Mars? Before we humans bring our Earth life forms, it's not just humans, right? We are all full of bacteria and other things that we bring with us. Before we have any kind of contamination of Mars, we need to understand what's already there. And that's why this is important. However, in the context of, is this important enough to spend $11 billion on? That's the big question, because Mars scientists are saying, well, maybe we don't need a one giant $11 billion program. Maybe we need several programs and have in situ understanding of what's going on. So when you bring the sample return back to Earth, you can do a whole lot more. But if you have a lot of different missions that are there, well, you can do a lot of different things. It might not be as good as if you bring it back. Another question is, for the entire scientific community, is it worth it? For James Webb Space Telescope, that was a $10 billion program, but it affected a lot of different sciences. A lot of different people got really good benefit from James Webb Space Telescope. Mars is only going to benefit the Mars community and maybe a little bit of other communities as well.
Essentially, instead of bringing the rocks to the lab, bring the lab to the rocks is one way to go around this $10 billion price tag, right?
Right. And that brings some challenges, because we don't actually have very good capacity to bring really good instrumentation in a miniaturized form to the sample, to the surface of Mars. But that is a thing that we can develop over time. However, if you talk to someone who really studies this, they want it in their laboratories.
And plus, it'd be cool just to have a Mars rock. So you talked about ballooning costs, Laura. Do we have an indication as to what that came from? Was this mission just financially forecast incorrectly? Or are we seeing issues of like inflation? The cost of bread, the cost of gas, the cost of Mars robots is going up because of price increases. What is the cause of these ballooning costs?
I believe that NASA has a history of significant cost overruns and schedule delays that also add to the cost. And this is no different. This is just a continuation of what NASA does. It proposes something that it wants to do, and it estimates a budget, but it usually does not do a good job. And in fact, the OIG report that just came out essentially said that during the formation phase of the program, there was a inconsistency and a lack of efficiency when it came to understanding the schedule and the budget for Mars sample return. And so that means that because of unrealistic projections, these costs then had to be adjusted over time and has been adjusted for several years and, in fact, is continuing to be adjusted. So it might not be $11 billion by the time it all said is done. It might be significantly more.
You also mentioned that there were layoffs because of this and cost cutting elsewhere in NASA. Can you dive into that a bit? What have we actually seen because of the funding to this program being held, and what could happen in the future if it isn't fully funded?
At the end of last year, in November, NASA leadership decided to really slow down Mars sample return, to take a step back, to pause. This was after the independent review in September that really was crushing news. And so when NASA decided to really roll back that budget, then there was anticipatory layoffs. And that's what we saw at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. It was a significant layoff most recently, and then smaller layoffs previously. And I unfortunately think that we're going to continue to see that, not just at JPL, but at other facilities that are affected. Mars sample return, it touches on a lot of different, you know, universities and other places where we are seeing this work, you know, slow down. And unless we get a better understanding of what the budget projections are, it's really hard to say to a company or a university, you need to hire X amount of people. You know, it's one of those things where you really need budget certainty. And that's something that NASA never has.
I've got to imagine, Laura, because you are a scientist yourself. You also are closely follower of what happens in DC and the budgetary realm of things when it comes to appropriations like this. Is this frustrating to scientists when they don't have that budget certainty and they don't know what's happening, but they know that this program could really do some good for our understanding of things? Can you kind of explain the frustration between these two worlds that might exist?
I think if you talk to anybody, there is a complete understanding that if NASA had an unlimited budget, yes, we would absolutely do Mars sample return. We'd do all kinds of fantastic science, but NASA never has an unlimited budget. And right now, NASA's budget is being squeezed. And because this is an election year, we're seeing a lot of disagreement within Congress, even more than usual, which means there's going to be less of an understanding of what the budget is going forward over, you know, the next year, the next few years. And so when you're thinking about projecting forward a large mission like this that takes, you know, years to decades to do, then that really is, it's almost guesswork. You really try to do the best you can with the information that you have right now, but knowing that Congress will change, knowing that the presidential administration may or may not change. So to get you an idea of timeline here, we're talking 2030 that they're anticipating that this mission right now is going to happen. You know, these launches in 2028 and lands on surface 2030, brings it back 2031. I mean, these are long timelines. And when you're projecting that far in the future, you just have to do the best you can. And as you mentioned earlier, inflation does affect things as well. These budgets, they are projected in 1 year, and then a decade or two later, it's going to be a different figure.
And it doesn't help that you have a quote unquote new boss every 2 years, right? With, congressional leadership changing, new people being voted into the House and Senate. And then every 4 years, the possibility of a new presidential administration, right? The goals change and where you want to spend the money change, does it not?
Exactly. And one thing we've seen is a emphasis right now on the moon. And Mars is currently secondary, where in the past, Mars was center stage, and we had a lot of fantastic robotic Mars missions. And now we have twisted that, so now it's moon to Mars, and we're really focusing on moon with Mars being secondary. But if we do want to send people to Mars eventually, which is the goal, then we do need to understand the geology of Mars and understand the life or potential life or past life of Mars, just so we can understand, how humans are going to affect that when we go to the red planet.
With all of that said, Laura, is the future for Mars sample return optimistic? Could the tides change and funding go to this? Or is this something that scientists and program leaders are looking elsewhere to figure out Mars?
Your guess is as good as mine. But one thing that is in its favor is that this is a partnership with ESA. Now, NASA has backed out of previous partnerships with ESA, but because it's an international program, it makes it a lot harder to back out of. NASA wants to be seen as a leader. And we do have congressional support. The House in general supports this. There are several strong members of Congress, in the Senate that support this. And I believe overall, scientifically, people are very supportive. Even people who do not directly work on Mars still want to understand what Mars was made of and how it was formed and picture humans on Mars someday. So I think eventually some version of Mars sample return will happen.
Laura Forsick is a space industry analyst and founder of the consulting firm Astrolytical. Laura, always great to have you on.
It's my pleasure.
Still to come, what it's like to live on Mars, on Earth.
Some of the things that were surprising, and this is kind of where the initial thing, and I went into the overview of that, it showed up because at the end of it, everybody and other analog astronauts that I have talked to after the mission, what they've reported was that challenging themselves and thinking, wow, I didn't know that I would be able to do this. But we came out the other side stronger for it. And that was kind of the theme.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to live on another planet? NASA is searching for volunteers to live in a Mars simulator for an entire year to see what it would be like for a crew to live and work on a simulated Mars mission. So what's it like to be away from the outside world in a replica of another planet? Here to answer that question is Sharifeh Gassel, the founder and director of The Space Therapist and NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador. She's also a previous participant in an analog astronaut mission and joins us now to share that experience. Sharifeh, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So NASA's looking for some volunteers for a year-long Mars mission, but this is not the only kind of analog astronaut research that is out there, and you yourself were a participant in the high seas. Let's start our conversation talking a bit about your experience being a Martian astronaut here on Earth.
I was assigned to a mission in high seas, which stands for the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, and that's an analog astronaut habitat in Hawaii. So there are analog astronaut habitats all over the world, and this is the one that I chose to go to and that I was assigned a two-week mission on. And so I was there as a researcher, and I am a licensed mental health counselor with a private practice on Earth and kind of my day-to-day. And I took some of my private practice and extended it out some of the research component of it. So that was basically, you know, what I did as an analog astronaut was some mental health research.
It's super interesting, and I'm glad you have these kind of backgrounds in those two things, and I want to explore that a bit, but I want to talk a little bit about the day-to-day in high seas first. Tell us a bit about what it's like living in this Martian habitat, this analog Martian habitat for 2 weeks.
So our mission, it depends if it's either a Moon or a Mars mission. They're kind of similar in some ways as far as kind of the daily schedule. So our mission began on Friday, I believe it was, at noon. And we were in the habitat for 2 weeks. And basically what we would do is have about a 16-hour wake day. And we would be given schedules, daily schedules, the night before in a debrief that we would have with our version of mission control. And they would basically set us up from beginning, waking up at 6:30 in the morning. We'd wake up and then go and have breakfast as a crew and do that from like 7 to 7:30, have a daily briefing. And then we would kind of go off and do our different tasks. Each of the crew members, there were six of us total, and we would each do our different tasks. Some of them would be anything from exercising 1 to 2 hours a day. And we would do that every day in addition to doing our own research for a couple hours a day. We were also assigned crew time, bond as a crew and group cohesion and everything. And the fun part for me personally was going out on the EVAs. So the extravehicular activities outside of the habitat, we would put on a spacesuit and be able to go outside of the habitat because we're simulating what it's like being in space. And we would go ahead and do the simulation with the airlock and depressurization in the habitat, step outside, do the EVAs for a couple hours, and then come back in and rinse and repeat for 2 weeks.
You have been involved in this community for as long as I have been, doing my job here. So you've got kind of an understanding as to what might happen at one of these analog missions. How did you prepare yourself for 2 weeks of isolation with this crew on quote unquote Mars?
I don't know if I necessarily prepared more than hoped for the best. So we weren't given a ton of preparation. The first time that we actually met each other, the first time the crew actually met each other was at the airport in Hawaii. And we did a couple Zooms ahead of time to get to know each other and figure out what our roles were going to be. And I served as the medical officer on our mission. And we all kind of picked different roles that we would all have and what we would be doing. And that was basically it beforehand. You know, I made sure that physically fit, you know, I could be in preparing physically what I could do and figuring out what we were allowed to take. I also consulted with an astronaut, Nicole Stott, and actually talking to her and seeing what I should prepare for or not in an analog environment. And so she gave some awesome pointers with that. But aside from that, it was kind of just going and being adaptable.
That is the key, right? Being adaptable there. And talk a bit about your research, because as we mentioned at the start of this, you know, you're a mental health professional. That's where your research is based, and that is what you practice in your day job. What were you looking to uncover or dig into with this 2-week analog mission?
Initially, I went in with trying to measure what's called the overview effect. And so the overview effect is a cognitive shift that has been reported with astronauts that have flown into space, looking back on Earth and noticing the awe and wonder of our planet and of space. And that was something that I wanted to see if I could measure in an analog environment. It was something that I started to notice in my private practice with my patients and my clients and kind of things that they would notice as they would transition to a different stage in their life. And my research, I went in kind of measuring that, but also measuring what it would be like to not only survive and what it would be like in long duration space flight, but also thrive. And so the research that I ended up studying was the impact of crew isolation and lunar simulation on human behavior. What all that means is that I measured basic needs that all people would have. So measuring sleep, measuring food, hygiene, job satisfaction, social fun, and later on exercise, and how that impacts our mental health and our mental wellness. Seeing so if that changes throughout the mission. So for example, we only got one shower in the 2-week mission. We had a lot of baby wipes. And so would not showering and having, you know, warm shower affect crew morale? Would it affect how we felt at the end of the day and kind of measuring on a daily basis? How did crew report? Same thing with food. We ate dehydrated food, vegetarian diet that we ate, similar, very different to what they would have on the ISS, but dehydrated in the sense that we didn't have the creature comforts of being able to go to the grocery store, getting whatever you want. And how did that affect crew morale? And so looking at those over a period of 2 weeks and then measuring kind of a pre-test and post-test. And that was kind of the basis of it.
One shower and freeze-dried food for 2 weeks, I would be an absolute menace. what did you find with the crew? I mean, was their mental wellness affected by this?
Yeah, it was funny because some of the things that were surprising, and this is kind of where the initial thing that I went in to measure with the overview effect, it showed up because at the end of it, everybody and other analog astronauts that I have talked to after the mission, what they've reported was that challenging themselves and thinking, wow, I didn't know that I would be able to do this. But we came out the other side stronger for it. And that was kind of the theme of it. One shower, but we had a lot of baby wipes. You know, not ideal, but it wasn't that bad. But it's definitely, it was not as bad as you would think, right? With food, it required us to get very creative. You know, in the beginning, it was like, are we running out of food? Are we, you know, what are we doing? And we didn't have any recipes or anything. We actually did use one of the recipe books from Dr. Cyan Proctor, who was on the first high seas mission, Meals for Mars, I believe was the name of the book. And we used some of the recipes from there, which were incredibly helpful. And trying to get morale up by being creative with food and, you know, kind of getting together and figuring out how we're going to pull through.
And how important was that kind of the interaction between the crew and breaking bread with them together and having those crew meals and being in it together for morale? Because I've got to assume, you know, you are isolated from the outside world. These analog missions, they have the same kind of communication with the outside world, right? There's delayed communication. There's nobody around you. How important was it to lean on your crewmates and have those moments together on your mental well-being?
Absolutely the most important thing. And this is where kind of having a crew with different backgrounds and, you know, diversity, but also different job opportunities and different job backgrounds comes in very handy so that you can pull from each other's strength and you can kind of come together. And crew meals were definitely important, right? We ate lunch and dinner every single day at the same time together. And it was where we kind of debriefed, where we laughed, where we joked around a lot of it. And it's important to know that your crew, you have each other's back. And so where one person might be having a rough day, the other rest of the team can come in and fill in the gaps. And for the longer duration missions and like the year on Mars and beyond those analogs, that's going to be really, really important to be able to count on your team and have that. You are isolated. And the nearest army base, which is the nearest habitat, was like an hour away. You have nothing else, right? We didn't really have internet. We had some internet limited, very, very limited, but no social media, nothing really that you would kind of go to in a pinch. And yeah, it's going to be important to figure out that you go with crew that you mesh well with. A bunch of different backgrounds so you can have conversation for a while.
Did that isolation affect you the way that you thought it would? Were you surprised by those 2 weeks of not being connected to the world as you were?
It was surprising in a good way. And you definitely find out who you're grateful for, what you're grateful for, and really connecting with, okay, I did this hard thing. What else can I do? You know, what other glass ceilings can I break? What else have I been limiting myself that maybe I shouldn't take myself out of the running, but I really should give myself more credit? And I think that's something that everybody can benefit from, and figuring out how do you push that. And so coming out of that, we did like a push-up challenge. That was something, it was like a not one against the other, but how many as a collective team, how many push-ups can we do at the end of this? It was completely for fun. And I went in thinking, okay, well, I can do like 10 push-ups. Great. By the end of it, I was doing like 150. And there is no way that you can get that much upper body strength in 2 weeks. What made the difference was limiting myself and also having the team checking in and the accountability piece. And if that's a metaphor for everything else, you know, kind of cool to think of, okay, well, how else can we grow?
Your high seas mission, as you mentioned, was 2 weeks. This NASA analog experiment is a year. But as we both know, a mission to Mars will be far more than 1 year in duration, one year of isolation, as you've described here. As someone who has participated in an analog astronaut mission, and as someone who researches human psychology and mental wellness and mental health, what do you see some of the challenges being in these long duration missions to places like the Moon and Mars? And what do we still need to answer before we can do these successfully?
So the 1 year long Mars mission, I believe, is in a 3D printed environment. And so that's something that we found a lot of help being able to go outside, even in our spacesuits, being able to go on the EVAs. They were a huge deal. Right? You would hopefully be able to do that on Mars itself. If they can replicate that to some capacity in the 3D analog, the year-long mission, that's hugely important. And in the high seas habitat, we had one window that we can look out of. There were kind of two windows in the hab, but only one that we could really look out of. So that was our only connection with actual sunlight. Hugely important for sleep, for a lot of other, you know, connection, for social connection in isolation. Very, very important for mental health. The other part of it is going to be where I noticed in some of my measures, maybe some trends, maybe with more increased sample size, kind of a something with the statistical significance of job satisfaction. That was the one measure that seemed to be affected most out of everything else, which was interesting for me. It wasn't food. It wasn't sleep. You know, those were affected. But when I think job satisfaction, I'm thinking, okay, now we're talking about maybe there's exhaustion, maybe there's burnout. And so if you're doing that, then how do you balance that with fun? How do you balance that with rest? How do you countermeasure? Okay, we have burnout if you're doing the same thing every time. Every day, that would be something that I would be curious to learn more about. And that might be even something that I learn in a future analog.
And that leads me to my final question. Are you going again? Maybe as an analog or for real?
Yeah, right. Maybe both. definitely going to the Analog Astronaut Conference in May, just registered to see where I can continue my research, where it would be maybe high seas. Maybe I can go back again, maybe another analog habitat that could align well with the research goals that I have. And yeah, if it's with one of the NASA ones, that would be awesome. Maybe even seeing with Johnson Space Center, they have what their research is, and who knows, hopefully.
That was Sharifeh Ghassel, a participant in the High Seas Analog Astronaut Experiment and mental health professional and researcher. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We're even on YouTube now. Or really, wherever you get your podcasts, we'll find you there. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Emily Ching. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.